Our second presenter is Martin Schmalz, an assistant professor of finance at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. As mentioned by Dan and also this morning, Martin and his co-authors have written the seminal papers finding that common ownership in competing firms has anti-competitive effects. He's a financial economist whose work examines how finance interacts with other fields of economics, including industrial organization, labor economics, monetary economics, and microeconomic theory. Martin?
Thank you very much for having me and for holding this hearing, and to NYU for hosting it. So I'd like to state for the record that I do hold a portfolio of ETFs, but have no other conflicts of interest to disclose. So I want to take a much broader view on what the theoretical literature on this topic has shown, and also speak about governance mechanisms and a few words on policy. So let me start with a benchmark model of competition that is really what we should think about, similar to what Adam Smith described in his Wealth of Nations. So what you imagine is a baker that is completely self-interested and tries to, you know, innovate, work very hard to undercut the bakery on the other side of the street and thereby compete for market share, for new customers. Okay? Now, this self-interest leads to maximization of social welfare. Now, a key assumption here is that each firm wants to maximize its own value, and that assumption is naturally satisfied when the firm is owner-managed and the owner's wealth is concentrated in one firm. Okay, so what's an example, though, of today's corporations where managers and owners might differ? Here's one illustrative example. Virgin America used to be an airline. The largest shareholder is Richard Branson, but not the CEO. And you ask yourself, how is it, by which mechanism is it that owners get firms to compete aggressively? They won't do it on themselves, by themselves, without incentives. And the media reports point to explicit directions by the owner to use the cash from the IPO for capacity expansions, buying new airplines, opening new routes, just expanding market share, stealing market share from Delta, United, and the other shareholders. Of course, he has the power to vote and can design incentives to back up this voice channel. Here's a quick illustration of to which lengths such an owner can go to attract market share. This is Richard Branson, you know, trying to attract market share from other players. Now, I'm kind of serious about this because the key question is, who takes that role? Who puts on the lipstick at Delta and United and Southwest Airlines? To find out, let's find out who the largest owners are. Well, the largest shareholder of Delta, Southwest, and United is Berkshire Hathaway. That's Warren Buffett's investment firm, who's also the third largest in Berkshire Hathaway, and the other owners are Vanguard, BlackRock, PrimeCap, State Street, in some proportion. So who's supposed to put on the lipstick? Warren Buffett? No? First at Delta, and then at United? Well, that seems absurd, no? And that's the point. The point is he has no economic incentives of doing that. No? If you steal market share from Southwest Airlines, you know, you call Southwest Delta and say, steal market share from Southwest. And you hang up, and you say, call Southwest and say, now you steal market share from Delta, hang up. Then you call United. That's completely absurd. It's against the economic interests of a common owner. And I use Scott's words from this morning. Common owners simply have weak incentives to engage in stewardship aimed at enhancing the value of particular companies. But they do have incentives to defer to the preferences of corporate managers. The question is, what happens then? You know, what happens is the corporate manager has weak incentives to cut costs, then costs are going to be higher, output is going to be lower in industry equilibrium, and product prices higher. That's an anti-competitive effect. Okay? So the key insight is, nobody needs to soften competition if there are no incentives to compete in the first place. That's a key insight. Okay? Let me give a few more empirical facts. The thing is, common owners are not in the minority, as we've heard much in this debate. There are almost no non-common owners left. If you look at the largest 100 shareholders of United, that own more than 91% of the shares, five of these shareholders are not common owners. 95 of them are. The largest of these non-common owners is number 42. Okay? They have absolutely no power, according to any theory I'm aware of, in these firms. And that's similar for American Delta and Southwest. There have been some claims in the literature suggesting otherwise, but if you read Einar's new paper he just posted, there's a correction to that record. Okay, now what happens in theory when you have few such investors left? And there's three decades, starting in the 70s, of formal theories and informal writings suggesting that compared to the textbook model, you'll get less competition if there are less incentives to do so. Okay, this is not a brand new theory. And all of them have a similar logic that I just explained. Okay, so let me give some details. It is true that the theory doesn't distinguish between asset owners or asset managers. you can either believe that asset owners have an incentive to maximize the total value of shares under management, or that they stick to the fiduciary duty by which they promise that they will do that for on behalf of its investors. But future work can figure out if that's an empirically important distinction. Okay? Another thing I should point out is I totally agree with Dan that we have no empirical evidence established theory explains how different common owners or different shareholders get the firm to have an objective function and how it therefore will behave. What we do have is a paper by Nobel laureate Oliver Hart that says, one thing we know is they won't agree on own firm profit maximization. And that's the key assumption in all of traditional antitrust. So I agree with everybody that robustness is needed in applications when it comes to the choice of control weights. Now, once more, the theories say that common ownership reduces incentives to compete. None of these theories says that common owners do nefarious things or incite collusion or do something like intentionally illicit. And that is clear from page one of the first formal theory on this topic, suppose no collusion is possible. Rotenberg says, note that this collusion need not be enforced, managers never need to meet with each other. He also writes, the mechanism for the collusive outcomes is reduced incentives to impede simply as a result of managers looking out for their shareholders. So these responses we've heard by the investor community, we don't ask firms to collude, we don't collude with anybody, has just little to do with what the claim is. Okay. That's a very important distinction. Because if you're waiting to find a collusive mechanism by which investors or firms collude, and you don't find any, that's the prediction of the theory. Okay, so you're likely to find false negatives, and everybody should be aware of that distinction. Now, what corporate governance tools do common shareholders use? Well, as a first order, all those that are available to them. That's voting, designing incentives, or a voice speaking to portfolio firms. And I'll show you just some examples of apparent deliberate attempts to reduce competition with these firms. Now, the important thing is academics are not going to produce much of this evidence because we don't have access to the data. That's where the role of the regulators would come in. First is, let's talk about incentives. Here's an empirical fact. If you measure which fraction of firm value goes to the CEO, that's a wealth performance sensitivity, and regress that on some measure of common ownership concentration, and by the way, this is robust to using other measures rather than MHHI, you get a negative correlation between those, and it's robust, a very robust finding. So what does it mean? Well, it means that the CEO has reduced incentives to cut costs, which means costs are going to be higher, which means output is lower, which means prices are higher. That's an anti-competitive effect. So what you get is this apparent paradox that it can be a weak principle in corporate governance and at the same time the cause for anti-competitive effects. Okay. Now, there's been some debate in the literature about the use of relative performance evaluation. Now, whether or not a contract features that is completely uninformative about its competitive incentives, because everything depends on how you measure performance. Do you measure performance in terms of value, in which case it can be pro-competitive, or in terms of margins? And to see that, here's one equation. Margins are price minus marginal cost, and usually prices fall when quantities are higher. Well, then maximizing margins means minimizing quantity. And Rock and Rubenfeld in their paper point out that American Airlines, the CEO's incentives are actually 100% based on relative income margins relative to the competitor. So that's actually an anti-competitive type of contract. Now, how relevant is this, not only in the data, but, you know, anecdotal? If you read the Wall Street Journal almost exactly a year ago, you find a group of investors meeting in New York trying to figure out how they can change executive incentives to reduce the output the frackers produce. That seems to me like a discussion about about product markets. Let's talk about voting. It is true that many institutions don't put their own employees on the board, but of course they vote on everybody else, all the directors. 2 years ago, Warren Buffett's deputy CIO, Todd Combs, was named to JP Morgan's board. The largest shareholders there are BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street Fidelity. Now, Bloomberg also pointed out that Berkshire is the largest shareholder in Wells Fargo, as well as in Bank of America, and many other, holds large stakes in many other banks, U.S. Bank Corporation, Goldman Sachs, American Express, and so forth. So, and of course, you can kind of predict that Combs is not going to propose competitive strategies or price war there. One of the instances in which voting is most important might be activism. If you're a large investor or the largest investor in a firm, it doesn't matter whether you like it or not, but you'll be pivotal in many elections. And we spoke about Trine this morning. They had a proxy fight at DuPont in which they explicitly asked for increased R&D spending, more relative performance evaluation as measured by value, and all with the explicit goal to increase market share. Now, they were voted down by BlackRock, State Street, Fidelity, each of which was a pivotal decision. And it's not me who concluded alone, but a prominent corporate law scholars that the most plausible hypothesis is that the large asset managers are concerned about the impact of activism on their broader portfolio. Commissioner Jackson this morning mentioned that if you talk to any person in the space, they'll confirm that the, they call them index funds, control America, that they're pivotal in all these proxy contests. We know in the established literature that hedge fund activism affects product markets. So if mutual funds affect hedge fund activism, we know there's an effect on product markets. I don't have time to go through the exploding literature on mutual funds' pivotal role in proxy contests. I'll just say, as early as 2008 in the Standard Finance journals, we have established that funds vote not in the interest of the individual firm, but in the interest of their portfolio, which is very much consistent with the assumptions of the literature. Now let's switch gears. Let's go to Southeast Asia and private equity. If you read The Economist, you'll find claims that the Vision Fund by SoftBank explicitly asked Uber and the ride-hailing firms to compete less feverishly and push up fares. It ended with Uber withdrawing from particular markets in exchange for cross-ownership stakes, and competition authorities in Southeast Asia challenged these deals. So do we see communication also about product markets in the US? Well, so this morning we had a representative of Value Act here. There was a US lawsuit by the DOJ against Value Act for a violation of a Hart-Scott-Rodino Act filing requirement. Now what Reuters reports is that this rings the alarm bells in the $16 trillion mutual fund industry, because the communications the mutual funds have are very similar to those that were cited in this lawsuit, and that the case comes as active and passive investors work more together to pressure management at underperforming companies, that activists court passive shareholders, and passive investors recruit activists. So I don't think this distinction between active and passive is all that important in that debate, but you know, empirically we can figure this out. Okay, so one might think that this was a warning shot. So the question arises, were topics touching on product market competition discussed since? Well, actually, this fracking case I mentioned happened long after that, so yes, they did. A few weeks ago, we had the institutional investors meeting, and perhaps we're all happy about this, to be clear, about reforming how guns are made or how easy they should be trackable and so forth. Larry Fink is on the record saying we can tell a company to fire 5,000 employees tomorrow, and at the same time we hear they insist no effect on product market outcomes. Now, in Germany, my translation of a headline is fund giant BlackRock lobbies for mergers of European banks. Now that is precisely what the Hart-Scott-Rodino Act was supposed to prevent. So apparently mechanisms exist for mergers, then I don't understand how mechanisms don't exist for affecting product market outcomes. Okay, so there's more. Matt Levine pointed this out. In earnings calls, a common shareholder saying, I'd like to Southwest to boost fares and also cut capacity. It's mysterious to me how anybody could think that owners don't have the ability to engage on topics that affect product market outcomes. Okay, so let me now move on and conclude. Given the theory we have and the magnitude of anti-competitive incentives documented, we'll speak about this afternoon, as well as the fiduciary duty of the asset managers to maximize the value of the portfolios of assets, as well as the abundance of mechanisms that at least potentially yield ability to affect product markets, we need overwhelming empirical evidence that anti-competitive incentives from common ownership never in any markets cause anti-competitive outcomes. And I don't think we have any evidence to that effect. I'll mention about 24 papers in the panel later on, many of them published in top journals, that document effects on prices, outputs, product market conversion, innovation, and many other outcome variables we care about here. So I don't think it is warranted to just focus on one particular paper. So the question arises of what we should do about the issue. And to me, two things stand out. First is collecting better data. It's a huge pain to deal with common ownership data. Chris Condon will speak about this later on. But for private firms, we don't even know who owns them as researchers. And I want to just make clear, if anybody uses an HHI screen, you are assuming that even if 100% of the shareholders of two firms completely overlap, 100% shareholder overlap, that they should be treated as completely independent firms. You have six shareholders, each owning 15%, and the antitrust establishment goes, completely independent firms, no impact because they hold less than 15%. What they hold cumulatively, we completely ignore. This doesn't make sense in economic theory. We have absolutely no evidence that supports that assumption, so therefore I think we should challenge it. Now, there are many open questions, and we'll raise many of them. Dan has mentioned a few of them, potential criticisms of what's been done in literature, and academics will study those, I'm quite confident. But there are many questions academics can't study because we don't have the data for it, and I think that's where the regulators come in. One is, this morning we heard, do engagement meetings feature topics touching on competition? All I know is from reading the newspaper, no? But how systematic is that? Well, academics won't deliver the answer. Or we heard, well, we want to know what the chain is from executive incentives to the price setting within firms. I think that's a fascinating question, and it is an open question, but academics are not going to answer that question. We don't have the data, okay? So the regulators need to think about how badly they want to know the answer to these questions. Okay, so I've always held back with policy proposals or endorsing them, but I do want to speak about a few arguments that I think are not warranted in this, and just missed the mark. And one of them is that any intervention would be all radical and new and based on brand new theories. I don't think that's true. Regulators understood long before this literature started about this problem. In the 1934 Senate Securities Report, again, Commissioner Jackson mentioned this morning, it reads, Congress must prevent the diversion of these trusts from their normal channels of diversified investment to the abnormal avenues of control of industry. And the SEC's, that's a typo, ICA, Investment Company Act Bill, reads, the national public interest is adversely affected when investment companies have great size and excessive influence on the national economy. And as the ICA is written, it applies to funds but not the management companies, which pointed Jack Bogle earlier this year to point out when and if our index funds get to 10%, all we have to do is start a second one and we'd be in technical compliance. We need new limits, okay? And we mentioned Jack Bogle's piece last September that he thinks we can no longer ignore the concentration of corporate power that is bundled in the so-called index funds. Okay, so one might ask, but what about the benefits of diversification? Well, that's been partially addressed. I'll just say quickly, the common ownership problem, as presently documented, has very little to do with households' ability to diversify. There might be this problem in the limit, but for the moment, that's not what the problem is. Berkshire Hathaway is not an index fund. Value Act is not an index fund. So there are many things one can do before even starting to think about touching index fund, although that might be the logical conclusion. I don't think I have time to talk about the more minutiae down here. Second is, common ownership reduces incentives to compete and potentially welfare because of the reduced cost of diversification they enable. This is an excerpt from Rotenberg, who says, government interventions which reduce diversification are potentially beneficial since they promote competition. So everybody is aware that mutual funds help reduce the cost of diversification, but that might be the fundamental problem behind it all. So I'm very glad that the SEC and the FTC talk to each other about this because they have different missions here. And the investors currently are caught in between this conflict, which has been in the room the entire day, but that is what the conflict is. It's not like, oh, but they help diversify investments and therefore we shouldn't do anything about it. This is the basic problem, okay? Now, I'll conclude by Rotenberg's conclusion, who literally points to mutual funds and says, by lowering the costs of diversification, they naturally induce more collusion, he means collusive outcomes. If managers follow the wishes of the ultimate recipients of the dividends, it may well be that the funds which concentrate on specific industries and those whose portfolio is very broad do the most harm. Okay, so that is just opening a debate indeed, as you've pointed out, on where we want to draw the lines between, do we want firms to act in the owner's interest, and to which extent do we want the owners to be diversified in unrestricted ways? And I don't want to chime in on what the correct trade-off here is, but that's what the debate is and what it should be about. Thank you.